Can you ever be all things to all people? Nope. The second of the opposition parties out with its assessment of today's provincial budget, Liberal budget, opens zero nursing home beds. The NDP says health and care crisis continues, saying that they failed to invest in much needed nursing home beds for Nova Scotia. Something else we can take on and take up with you or perhaps other guests on the radio. You can find us anytime. The Sheldon McLeod Show on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the S McLeod Show. And of course, right here on the air on News 95.7. Love to hear from you. Love your feedback. Thanks for sending your emails and your tweets. We'll be chatting coming up a little bit later on with the Conservative Shadow Minister for National Defence Canada for the first time in many years. We'll be heading into a peacekeeping mission. In fact, as John Ivanson writes in the National Post, more about image than national security. In fact, he uses a quote from retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire. I wouldn't touch Mali with a 10-foot pole. That was back in 2016. Has that changed? Has anything changed? We'll talk a little bit about that with the opposition conservatives in just a few moments. We'll hear from a professor, Duncan McIntosh, when we talk about the age of intelligent machines and autonomous weapons coming your way. And we'll also touch base with Kathy McCarthy and, in addition to Rochelle Owen, about McNabb's Island. But as we continue the conversation here this afternoon, this is something brand new, or at least new to us here in the East Coast of Canada. Home Roots announcing its Atlantic series, bringing its winning musical formula to Atlantic Canada. What the heck is this all about? Well, that's what we hope to endeavor to learn in the next few moments as we join Leonard Podolak from Home Roots on the line this afternoon. I believe we reached him in Winnipeg this afternoon. Leonard, are you there?
Yeah, sure am. How are you, Sheldon?
Very well, sir. And what's it like in Winnipeg today?
Oh, actually, believe it or not, it's not so bad. I think it's going to get to be about +2 today. I just returned from a trip to Denmark. I'm also a professional musician myself on tour, so I came home expecting it to be a lot colder, but I was pleasantly surprised. Not so bad.
You're a musician, banjo?
Yeah, I played five-string banjo for 20 years. I played in a band called The Ducks, and that ended in the last years. And so now I'm very lucky to be a part of this amazing nonprofit organization bringing different kinds of music to people's living rooms all across the country.
House concerts. It's an emerging field, but it's not really. If you think about it, it's what it used to be. It used to be people who gather in a place and enjoy music together. So where did this Home Roots come from?
Exactly. Well, exactly. Chamber music was originally played in chambers and in people's houses. The organization was started by the same people that founded the Winnipeg Folk Festival, the Vancouver Folk Festival, as well as the Stan Rogers Folk Festival in Canso, Nova Scotia, and that would be my parents. And they sort of saw my career unfold with the Ducks, and even when we had a big major record label and a big booking agency, we would often find ourselves in situations where we had a show somewhere in Michigan, and maybe the next gig would be in Alberta or something like that. And we really thought hard, and if you added up all of the infrastructure for folk music in Canada and artists on tour doing a national tour in the major venues, there's basically about a month worth of work. So we were trying to figure out ways of creating more infrastructure for acoustic and folk music in Canada and more shows for artists. And so they thought about house concerts and what if you could create tours of house concerts. So that's exactly what we've done. Right now we have 12 tours that go across the country. They each operate 6 times. So a host would take on 6 shows a year, and sometimes they partner with their friends too. So if someone can't commit to 3 to 6 shows, they'll do 3 shows, and basically they tell all their friends, rearrange all their furniture, and make like a mini concert venue in their living room so they can get 30 or 40 people, hopefully, and a national act or an international act will come through, and it's exactly like a professional concert except for there's no PA system. You know, you do 2 sets and you put up the artists for the night, feed them dinner, and you get this whole experience at your house instead of going out to a public place.
Leonard Podolak is here. Home Roots, as it was described to me, if you love music to entertain for friends and family, and you have a home or another non-traditional space, you can hold up to 25 people or more. You can be a volunteer host with Home Roots. Part of my brain went to, okay, I've been to house concerts, and it's a lot of fun. The artists sometimes will book it in between other dates, so it can kind of coincide with another tour. Sounds like that you're trying to backfill some of that right here with this initiative. But in this growing age where it's far more difficult to get people out, it's a challenge to get people to spend their hard-earned dough on live entertainment.
Yeah.
Is there any risk that you're going to end up, well, perhaps eating your own lunch?
Oh, well, you know what we've found out is that, generally speaking, people in rural communities, they have a hard time coming to the cities to like, if you think about it, if you live a couple hours away from the city and someone you want to go see is coming, you have to fill up the car or the truck with gas, plan the hotel, plan the booking of the restaurant and the whole deal. It adds up to a few $100. This is a way for people at almost zero cost. I mean, really, like if hosts want to do a potluck, then, you know, the people bring the food, there's no actual guarantee to the artist for how much they're going to make. They just get 100% of the door. So what's really amazing, and this is something that I've discovered myself as an artist, is that, you know, you can have these huge infrastructure tours, or you can go on more low-key tours like this, and what winds up happening is even though the numbers aren't as high, the number that ultimately winds up in the pocket of the artist winds up being higher than, you know, the year my band made $1 million. We all made about 15,000 or 16,000 from the Ducks.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, we were nominated for a Grammy and won a Juno and all that stuff. And it was the perception was that we were very famous and successful, and we were, but there was also this massive infrastructure driving our band. So this is a way for artists who are doing side projects, people who are just developing as artists, people who have been on the folk scene for a while and maybe aren't, you know, trendy anymore but are still amazing. It's basically open to all artists in all stages of their career. And we don't discriminate based on who your publicist or who your record deal is. We just have to believe that the artist is going to do a great job and be something diverse or bring something unique and help us create a diverse lineup.
I got to say, I've spoken to artists and that reaction you get, the feedback you get from an audience, even more so if you're in a room with 25 people, that you get a different perspective on the music.
Well, that's right, because, you know, it's sort of, there's the fourth wall doesn't exist. It really is sort of under a microscope. You know, there's no big stage, there's no lights, there's usually no PA system, and so a lot of the regular infrastructure of concerts isn't there. So you're right there. So everybody is really creating the experience, and that's what makes it so special. Is that, you know, you as an artist or as an audience member, you really develop a rapport with the other people in the room. You know, between the sets, you hang out with the artists often, and after the show too. So it becomes like the social gathering. So, you know, the significance of the show is often just as important as a social gathering with the host and their neighbors as it is for the artist as a new place to play. And it's a great way for an artist to build up a following, you know, one person at a time, or 25 people at a time, or 40 people at a time. It's, you know, but it's like really significant experience as opposed to a big hit, or, you know, like a, you know, you're on, when you're on the radio, it's great, you know, you, for an artist or for the TV, and often, you know, you can get a lot of people all at once, and some of those people will stay with you, but a lot often with these personal little connections, it's really amazing.
Leonard Podolak, Executive Director, Home Roots. We have not mentioned how people perhaps have a chance to do this. How do they put their name forward to you?
Oh, yeah. So basically, just go to our website, which is www.homeroots, and that's HOMEROUTES.ca, and follow the links. There's I Want to Be a Host. Or you can call us at 204-480-3380 and just talk to us. But basically, we're just going to get you to send a photo of your place, a description of your house, talk to you about your intentions and why you want to do it, and if it all sort of fits with the intention. It's basically what it is it's all trust. You know, the artists do the tour and send us the commission at the end of the tour. It's the only gig I've ever done where I've paid the employer at the end, you know, instead of the other way around. And you know, we trust the host to do a great job. The host trusts us to send great artists. The artists trust us not to send us into the abyss. And so it's a three-way kind of, you know, we're all in it for the right reasons. So if everyone's in it for the right reasons and they can accommodate the artist for a night a few times a year, then pretty much anyone is welcome. So, yeah, www.homerouts.ca.
Well, I got to say, there is no real win-win. That's called a tie, and the tie goes to the runner. You guys are running a great promotion, a great idea, and I hope this is successful. I hope you're able to find some hosts here in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, well, we're certainly excited. We've got a lot of hosts on PI, so we want to build it up in Nova Scotia. So I sure appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about this.
All right, Leonard, all the best. Enjoy your day, and I hope winter is done and spring arrives in Winnipeg today.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sheldon.
You take care. Leonard Podolak is mentioned, is with Home Roots, and you can find them on social media everywhere. We're going to shift gears a bit, take a break, and when we return in just a few moments, again, happy spring. John Iveson was writing about this. Others are talking about this. In fact, Lisa Raitt, a frequent guest on this program, she has been on for a while. She, yesterday as deputy leader, stood in the House and asked the Prime Minister what assurance is he giving us as Canadians, that our peacekeepers in Africa will be as safe as possible. And I guess the other question is, what about when they return? What supports are in place for them? We'll talk about that when we return with the Conservative Shadow Minister for National Defence, James Bazin, right after this. All right, welcome back to the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. With a small exception, Canada has been out of the peacekeeping game, if you will, for many, many years. And as we learned this week, we will be sending a combination of helicopters and personnel to a hot spot in the world. In fact, as we are learning, Mali, one of the most dangerous UN missions in the world so far, 162 UN forces have died, and according to some, 80% of the force's resources spent on self-protection in the midst of a civil war. He is the Conservative Shadow Minister for National Defence. James Bazin is here with us on the broadcast this afternoon. Thank you for doing this, sir. How are you?
Thanks for having me on the show, Sheldon.
I know yesterday Lisa Raitt had a chance to ask the Prime Minister what assurances we have that our troops will be kept out of harm's way. It is a war zone. It is a peacekeeping mission. Let's be honest. There's not peace. It's not about the peace. It's about this fight. What do you feel about Canada's role in this peacekeeping mission?
Well, you're right, Sheldon. It is a combat mission. There is no peace to be kept in Mali. You don't only have the warring factions fighting for a civil war and the separatists up in the north. You also have, you know, numerous Islamic terrorist organizations that are operating that are very well equipped and well trained. The French have said that they're better at fighting than the Taliban were in Afghanistan. And they're the ones that have caused the most damage and created the most casualties and deaths to peacekeeping forces. And they're not just doing roadside bombs and taking pot shots from the bushes. They're actually attacking military installations where our peacekeepers are going to be housed. They have, you know, surface to air missiles that they got from Libya. They got rocket propelled grenades, and so they have the heavy artillery that will make this an incredibly dangerous mission, the most dangerous UN mission in the world. And really, Justin Trudeau hasn't provided us with any sound reasons how this is in Canada's national interest. I believe that this is him trying to save face after his disastrous trip to India. He had an embarrassment in China. He almost deep-sixed the TPP talks in Vietnam. And so he's trying to get some credibility back at the international scene, and he feels the only way he can do that is to go into this UN peacekeeping mission, which for over 2 years now, they've had a chance to do this before, and they have said no to.
We have on our program this afternoon James Bazin. When former retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire calls this a problem area, worried perhaps that Canadian soldiers may lose their lives. I know the Prime Minister wasn't willing to engage in that conversation, saying this is about entering into this with the attempt of trying to provide some kind of higher level, or I guess the Minister of Defense called it a smart pledge with the air support. But if there are perhaps challenges, if there are weapons that could be targeting our aircraft, what do you make of why we're going?
Well, again, we don't see how this is in national interest. This is about Justin Trudeau trying to get his mojo back on the international scene and trying to get a seat on the UN Security Council. So he's definitely trying to win favor with those at the United Nations. But this is the concern that we have, and what Romeo Dallaire experienced in Rwanda, and this could be another Rwanda, another Somalia, and it's already more deadly than those missions with 162 peacekeepers already been killed. Blue helmets have become targets. What's the chain of command here? Is it going to be a UN bureaucrat sitting in New York telling our troops what to do? And what are the rules of engagement? Will we be able to proactively go out there and eliminate the threat? Or are we only allowed to defend ourselves? And got to keep saying this, that there is no peace to keep, because there is no peace agreement between the terrorist organizations, the Tuareg up in northern Mali, or the government. And we got to remember, the government already failed once with a military coup just in 2012. So, there's so many problems here and so many different nations that are partnered in. How is this going to work in the best interests of our Canadian Armed Forces? And as you said in the lead up to the show, we have the situation of how we're going to deal with, dealing with malaria. Is it going to be methylquin and all the side effects that has that causes PTSD and exasperates the problems with psychosis? What about how we deal with Ebola, which is in the area? And what about those that come back with PTSD because of the atrocities that they have to witness and not be able to stop?
With that in mind, the Chief of Defense Staff, General Jonathan Vance, says this is going to happen. Is it that it's happening, or is that this is the location? Should Canada be actively involved in peacekeeping through through the United Nations on this global, not necessarily this particular fight, but should Canada be engaged in peacekeeping?
Well, we know that Canada had a chance to participate in the UN mission in Colombia, and they passed. We would have supported that. That's a trading partner of Canada. It's definitely in our national interest. We had a pretty large contingent involved in Haiti with the UN. We're out of there now as well, but we could go back, and we have a huge Haitian population here that has strong family connections back to the island. And we have, as conservatives, been saying that the military mission that we have currently in Ukraine should be turned into a UN peacekeeping mission, that there's an opportunity to bring peace to the eastern part of Ukraine, to get all the players at the table. Ukraine has requested Canada should champion it at the UN, and that would be an ideal role for our peacekeepers in bringing stability back into Europe.
I'm just reading here, in the coming days, government will register its pledge with the United Nations. The Canadian Armed Forces will begin their planning process. We don't, again, know when soldiers will leave. We don't exactly know how many will go. I suspect this will be, what you'll be doing in the House, asking these questions of the Prime Minister and the Minister.
Yeah, we're asking for a debate. We're asking for a vote on this so that members of Parliament, on behalf of their constituents, can pronounce themselves on this mission. And we have those questions and so many, many more, including the rules of engagement, chain of command. And, there is talk that special operation forces are going over. So if we're putting boots on the ground, not just the air task force and not just close combat support, but if we're actually going to be going into theater, we got to have those answers before the decision is made to send our troops overseas. But I'll say this, that as conservatives, we have nothing but our full confidence in the brave men and women who serve in the Canadian Armed Forces, that they're well-trained, they do have the equipment when they're provided with it, that they can take on any task that the Government of Canada calls upon them to do.
The member for Selkirk, Interlake, Eastman, James Bazin, thank you for doing this, sir, and lots of interest in the story, and we'll continue to follow it. Thank you for this.
Thanks for having me on the show, Sheldon.
Take care, sir.
Bye.
James Bazin, Conservative Shadow Minister for National Defense. We will take a break. Is this the right mission? Are we there? We'll certainly be putting our men and women in harm's way. Will there be loss of life? I suspect there will be. heading into this hotspot. I don't know enough about this to suggest that I'm an expert, then we'll continue to reach out to people who follow this much more closely than I do. We'll be back after the 2:30 news, but what's wrong with having a discussion? Not a single thing. After the break, Duncan McIntosh is a university professor, and we'll talk about autonomous weapons and killer robots, and we'll continue this conversation just after the news update. Coming your way next, more on the budget right after this. And welcome back. You're listening to the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. A big thanks to Katie Hartai helping out as producer today. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, after 3 o'clock, Bill Casey joins us. Member of Parliament will discuss with us better rural internet. And Nova Scotia's budget included some money that we'll see some investment in that. Is there some federal money on the table? We'll ask Bill Casey of that coming up. Also, Trevor Omlaw is a recipient of an organ donation several years ago. And there are a couple of stories in the news in the last few days about one, a man who was getting a double lung transplant. Another, a man who went to Facebook, went to social media to ask for help. Someone actually responded and is donating a kidney. There's this movement, this ongoing sense that we need to have, automatic consent when it comes to organ donation, that we should all automatically have our organs donated unless we specify otherwise. And you know, I think that makes some sense. It does make some sense. We'll speak to Trevor about that coming up in a bit. A few moments we're going to dig into in about 10 minutes or so. We'll hear from Rochelle Owen, who has spent some time on McNabb's Island taking pictures. Learn more about that coming up in a few moments. But our next guest, just reading from the Dal News page, Democracy, Freedom of Speech, the Rule of Law. When we talk about these types of principles, our next guest has been very much able to engage people in these conversations. In fact, there's an event coming up in a few days. I think it's in a few days. It's a debate. Department chair in the Department of Philosophy, War in the Age of Intelligent Machines, Noel Sharkey debates Duncan McIntosh, the role of autonomous weapons and killer robots. Sounds like an interesting conversation, to say the least. Welcome to our program, Professor McIntosh.
Thanks so much, Sheldon.
Are you talking about the book that was written? Because there is a book of that title about, you know, dealing with the specific war in the age of intelligent machines that dated back to the first Gulf War.
The person who designed this talk may have had that in mind for the title, but I don't know about that book, and it's not specifically on that theme.
Okay, so when we're talking the philosophy of automation and smart, intelligent machines, where does this conversation take us?
So Noel Sharkey, the person I'm debating, is a retired engineer who's very concerned that autonomous weapon systems, killer robots, to speak euphemistically, are going to get deployed prematurely and without adequate regulation. So he's trying to have them banned worldwide in the same way that the Geneva Convention and the United Nations have banned cluster munitions, blinding lasers, poison gas, landmines, and the way some people want to ban nuclear weapons. He thinks they're just too dangerous. I think that they, in fact, have subtle, plausible uses, and that in some situations they could produce morally superior outcomes. So that's going to be what our debate is about.
And he's not the first, he's not the only one to perhaps bring this to our attention. A noted scientist who passed away recently was worried about artificial intelligence. And when we talk about this issue, are we talking about, you know, this sense that machines are going to start to think on their own and that they'll see us as a threat? Is that your interpretation of the argument against them?
Well, that's sort of the headline thing, but I think that's so far away that it's merely a speculative possibility. It's so very difficult to make an intelligent machine do anything that I think if we sat down and tried to make one take over the world, it would take us an awfully, awfully long time to design such a machine, and the odds that they're going to design themselves to do that are very small. I think the real issue is this. There are all kinds of economic incentives for in defense industries to produce these weapons, these weapons that could companion soldiers in war fighting. And if they're not regulated properly, they could be quite dangerous. The big issue is this. Can they be designed to respect international humanitarian law and the laws of war, which has three parts: kill soldiers, not civilians, only kill as necessary for military objectives, and don't kill more than needed for the objective. The people are worried that robots in the foreseeable future won't be able to respect those rules.
Well, humans don't respect those rules. That's the real challenge to this conversation.
That's pretty important right there.
Yeah, we were just chatting about this upcoming Canadian peacekeeping mission. There is no peacekeeping in a war zone. So in ways of, you know, trying to get our heads around this, you know, war in the age of intelligent machines. We're talking about this debate that's coming up in a few days. Is it Thursday? Is that when this is happening?
It's tomorrow night, actually.
Oh, tomorrow night. Okay, sorry about that. And we've got with us a professor in the department of philosophy at Dalhousie University. I really, really, you know, question the... Just look at Siri on my iPhone. If there was ever any fear that it would intentionally harm, but mistakenly act on what it thinks it hears, that's where I think the real problem lies with technology.
Yes, it's absolutely a concern, but we can do an awful lot about that. And one of the things we can do is make sure we understand what their design gives them the capacity to do, and then only deploy them in missions where that would be a good competence. So there are some places where there's no danger, really, that the machine is going to do something wrong. Suppose it's designed to shoot down anything that flies over an aircraft carrier that doesn't give a civilian transponder response when it's radioed. I mean, you just know that if it's over an aircraft carrier, it's an attacking device, shoot it down. Likewise, if you're patrolling a demilitarized zone, or if you're in aerial combat, there are certain situations where anything the targeting device is likely to find is something that's properly thought to be a target in war. There are other situations where you need a vastly more intelligent machine before you'd put it in there, situations where you might want the machine to be responsive to surrender, to the presence of child soldiers, to contrition, to people who are just so scared they don't know what to do. You know, that's above their pay grade right now. Well, don't put them there. And that's how you get these things to be both used. And it's important to use them because they can save the lives of soldiers, they can save the conscience of soldiers, and with any luck, they'll result in a lot fewer civilians being killed too, because you can make them as precise as the design allows.
With that in mind, you know, we see the smart technology, the drones that were being employed by U.S. military forces. That seems to be a trend, but yet again, here we are talking about sending men and women from the Canadian forces to Africa to keep the peace. You're suggesting that perhaps it would make sense to have robots or some other kind of technology do that?
Yeah, the idea is that there are situations where if you don't have to, you don't want to use a soldier. If the environment is dirty because there's poison gas or nuclear radiation, if there's great danger of the soldier sustaining a kinetic injury from a bullet or a blast, or if the job is incredibly boring and it's very hard for a human to pay attention for a long period of time, that's when you want to automate the process. Those are some of the examples. And anytime you can save the life of a soldier or save the conscience of a soldier, modern warfare is amazing. You're almost more likely to die from suicide, from post-PTSD and guilt, than from an enemy bullet. And if we can delegate some of these tasks to robots who can do the necessary killing for us, that's all to the good.
We've got Professor Duncan McIntosh with us. He's Department Chair, Department of Philosophy at Dalhousie University. With that in mind, and perhaps you heard this story that there was a self-driving car Uber had been testing that ended up taking the life of a pedestrian.
Yes.
Today we hear, well, perhaps the pedestrian in law was in the wrong, but that really doesn't matter to that family. And it's changed perhaps this company's, the perception people have of this company and its goal of ending, you know, drivers behind the wheel. So will we have to fail before we find success in this idea that you have?
Almost certainly, depending on how you define failure. I mean, suppose in a whole year, an automated car kills one person, and compare that to the number of people who are killed in ordinary road deaths by cars driven by humans, which would be of the order of 60,000 people. Then I would count that a success. It's, you know, all technology has hazards. The question is whether or not these things are being prematurely deployed, I guess. And if there's been irresponsibility there, that would be good to find out. But I doubt any technology is going to be perfect. So there are always going to be these nightmare stories. But you have to do the math and find out overall what's the safer device, a human or an automated device.
It's a fascinating area of debate and discussion, for sure. And you'll continue it tomorrow night as part of this this conversation.
Yeah.
But with that in mind, you know, a million deaths is a statistic. One is a tragedy. When we talk about the failures, we have to fail before we succeed or can succeed. Are we arguing about the future? Because in many ways, this is the present, where we're talking about this intelligent machinery and warfare that involves devices.
A device that would be like you or me is a long way in the future, but a device that can be semi-automated, that can kill more carefully and precisely and efficiently than a human, that's already here. So the aircraft carrier defense devices I talked about, they're already here. Devices that can patrol demilitarized zones, they exist. And we're going to be seeing more and more of these things, devices that will be capable of aerial combat using G-forces that a human being couldn't support. That's not too far away.
Mm. And then the question remains, to what end? Who's going to control this force and this power?
Well, hopefully it'll be the good people. I mean, it goes without saying, I think, that I'm only in favor of these things to the degree that they are part of an overall movement to try to solve these problems peacefully. A lot of the conflicts in the world, they are based in just complaints, and we ought to be negotiating our way through those, not trying to kill our way out of insurrections.
Professor Duncan McIntosh, good luck with the debate tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the conversation today.
Thanks for your interest, Sheldon. Bye-bye.
Thanks. You take care. Duncan McIntosh is department chair in philosophy at Dalhousie University. This discussion happening tomorrow. I have to dig up exactly the when and the where, but it'll be on campus for sure. Conversation with or a debate with Professor McIntosh and Noel Sharkey about the role of autonomous weapons and killer robots. We're going to take a break, and we're going to head back to McNabb's Island for a few moments. We'll be back with more of our broadcast in just a few moments. And, yeah, I forgot to print off exactly when that event was going to happen, so I had to find it on the internet. It will be tomorrow night from 7 until 8:30, St. Mary's University Scotiabank Theatre in the Sobeys Building. Dr. Noel Sharkey, chair of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, debating Dr. Duncan McIntosh, professor of philosophy at Dal, and the role of autonomous weapons, as we said. What's the future going to look like? What does it mean for us? How concerned should we be? And that, again, is tomorrow, if you're interested. You can find out more online. All right, let's talk a little bit about this. In fact, there was a conversation about, well, the AGM, the annual meeting, and photography presentation. That's what interested me. You're going to chat a little bit about McNabb's Island and, first of all, bringing her into the conversation, someone who's been involved for many, many years. She is president of the Friends of McNabb's Island Society. Kathy McCarthy is with us on the program. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sheldon. How are you?
Very well. Very well. Big day coming up March 21st, eh?
Yes, yes. First day, official day of spring, although I guess it happens this afternoon.
Yep.
But tomorrow will be the first full day of spring. So we're thinking about the future and thinking about the island. And Rochelle is going to show us some of her wonderful photographs that she's been taking of the island over the years.
All right.
So it'll be great.
You mentioned her. She will be the special guest speaker. And Rochelle Owen is with us on the broadcast. Rochelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm just reading here, you have been working in environment and sustainability for 25 years. How long have you been taking pictures?
Longer than that.
So tell me about that first trip you took to McNabb's.
That would have been over 20 years ago. I went on my first beach sweep and was intrigued and connected right from the beginning.
This opportunity tomorrow for people to see what you've captured. Tell me a bit about the pictures that people will have a chance to see.
The presentation is going to be around the five senses, so exploring all the beautiful imagery from that perspective, looking at smells, touch, sound, sight, and taste. And I had the fortunate time to go over there every month out of the year and crawl around the island in all different parts.
Let's go back to you, Kathy. You know, this event tomorrow is for what? What end? What are you hoping people will take away from it?
Well, it's really for people who can't actually get over to the island this time of year, and it is difficult in the winter time. But Rochelle will be able to show us some of the hidden places on the island. And I always like to say that McNabb's is a place where you might go for a hike, but you just stumble upon history. It doesn't matter where you go. And Rochelle's been able to capture a lot of the old fortifications and the buildings that are on the island, but they've kind of gone back to nature, so to speak.
Mm.
So that'll be a good opportunity for people to learn a little bit more about McNabb's and to just to have a good evening exploring the island from a distance.
Kathy McCarthy, president of the Friends of McNabb's Island Society. Tomorrow it's a photographic journey, The Five Senses by Rochelle Owen. Rochelle is here with us as well on the program. She's with the Office of Sustainability. But is this more from your position or your role as a photographer, as a volunteer, as a member of the arts community?
Yes, yes, definitely.
Okay, with that in mind, when we're talking about the annual beach cleanup and the trash and the debris and what rolls up onto the shores of this island, has that been documented over the years? Is this a part of your display?
Definitely, all the times I've been over there, whether it was 21 years ago or now, I do take pictures of the different types of marine debris, and you can see parts of the island collect different kinds of marine debris depending on the uses. So, for example, Ives Cove has a lot more small plastics that are from the urban environment, and the other south end of the island have more fishing debris.
Mm. Is it getting better or getting worse? Are you able to tell?
I would say it's still present there, and the types of debris that we're getting are pretty consistent from what I have observed over the years.
Mm. As mentioned, our guests, Rochelle Owen and Kathy McCarthy. Kathy, how many years now has this cleanup been going on?
We've been doing it since the early 90s, and we've collected over, well, it's shocking, really, 13,000 bags of garbage. So we can expect to collect about 500 bags, 400 to 500 bags every year. This year, the cleanup is June 3rd, and we do have a lot of volunteers that are always keen to help out. But it's, you know, the garbage really hasn't diminished in years. Like Rochelle said, there's a lot of marine debris. Last year we found over 30 lobster traps that had washed ashore. We'll still find a lot of city garbage like Tim Hortons cups and plastic bags and garbage that should never be in the environment in the first place.
Yeah, clearly, if it washes away in a big deluge of rain, or perhaps the snowplow pushes it towards the gutters and it ends up in the stormwater system, you know, I can see where it happens,
yeah.
Where it does, you know, and it's not directly related to human behavior, but it is created by human activity.
Right, exactly, yeah. And so McNabb's is, it's also a really good place to see and to witness climate change happening, because there have been so many storm surges and sea level rise that you can see the beach has eroded in many places. And it's a pretty dramatic local example of what's been happening.
Rochelle, has that been something you've been able to document? Can you see how it's changed in the 20-odd years?
For sure. I would say we see a lot of erosion, and certainly photos from different sites around the island. Even a week or so I was over there, and the storms that are hitting Hangman's Beach are causing quite a bit of degradation there.
Mm. Yeah, and I heard, Kathy, you were speaking of that earlier today, just the ongoing erosion. But that's been obviously happening for years. What do we know about the physical evidence as to how this island has changed over the decades or centuries?
Well, we have some old aerial photographs, and you can see the change. The change, beaches tend to be dynamic anyway. They are always changing. You can see it because it's been documented in aerial photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and bathymetry maps as well. So that's the evidence. And it also has a lot to do with the type of soil that McNabb's is. It's a drumlin, so there's a lot of, which was created from the ice age, and there's a lot of small particles, fairly good soil for farming, but it's also very pliable and movable.
That is our guest, Kathy McCarthy, president of Friends of McNabb's Island Society, and we're also joined by Rochelle Owen. Rochelle has been working as a volunteer, has taken many pictures over the years, and her work will be displayed, A Photographic Journey of the Five Senses. How do you represent smell in a picture?
Well, you know, the first thing that hit me in part of the island that maybe a lot of people don't go to is the knee-high seaweed that comes up on the Cullinton Cove area, the point. And especially in the springtime, there's big hills of seaweeds, and all the robins come there, and it releases a sulfur smell. So the smells, depending on where you are on the island that type of year, are very strong.
I think many of our listeners would recognize what you're describing right now, whether or not they recognize that it's also endemic to this particular island. But that sewage kind of smell, it's there.
Sulfur, yeah.
Sulfur. Okay, so that said, you know, that's the smell part. What about the hearing, the sound? Can you capture that in a photograph?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the sounds that you hear are bird sounds. There are so many birds at McNabb's Island, and, of course, many more come back for the spring and the summer. We hear noises from the city, so, you know, on McNabb's from Ives Point, you can get vistas of the whole downtown, and so you hear noise from there. So there's a lot of different sounds that are emanating through the island, whether natural or human-created.
Rochelle, before we let you go, do you have a favorite photograph? Do you have a favorite image that will be on display tomorrow?
Yes, I do, and I encourage people to come, and I can tell you about it.
That's what they call a teaser in this business. Rochelle, thank you for doing this. It was a pleasure to meet you on the radio today.
Thank you very much.
All right, all the best to you.
Okay,
cheers. And we'll leave with Kathy as we discuss what will happen tomorrow. It's the annual general meeting. Is there an election of officers, or are you up for re-election?
Yeah. Also, we've got a special presentation. We're going to have a video of Nova Scotia's celebrated poet, George Eliot Clarke, reading his poem on McNabb's Island. So there's something else to show the creativity of the island.
All right.
The photographs and the poems, a good combination.
The 28th annual general meeting, if people are not a member today, are they allowed to join tomorrow?
Oh, yes, sure. Right. The meeting is open to the public. It's going to be at the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic on Lower Water Street on the Halifax waterfront. It starts at 6:30 and should run till about 9 or so.
Yeah.
So we've got the business meeting at first, which it doesn't take very long, and then the presentation.
All right. Well, Kathy, thanks for sharing this with us today. I know you were on earlier in the day on this radio station, but I think we got a different perspective as to what people can expect for tomorrow.
Yeah, great. And I'd encourage people to go to our website, mcnabsisland.ca, and there's some of Rochelle's photos are on the website, and there'll be more throughout because she's graciously given us the access to all her photos. So anytime we are looking for a lighthouse picture, for example, we've got some great ones that Rochelle has taken.
All the best tomorrow. Thanks for doing this, and we'll learn more about the cleanup as we get closer to June 3rd.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks
take
for
care.
Your interest. Maybe we'll see you there.
All right, Kathy.
Bye, Sheldon.
Bye-bye. That is Kathy McCarthy, president, Friends of McNabb's Island Society. We're going to break for the news, the latest on the budget that was released earlier today by the Liberals. I see some criticism that a lot of the revenue is counting on weed money, cannabis cash. We'll talk a little bit about that. And we'll talk about the Internet. In fact, after the news update, it's Bill Casey, member of Parliament and advocate for better rural Internet in Nova Scotia. We'll see if our federal government has any cash in the till for that. We'll be back after this on News 95.7.